treatment of general relativity. So in after some motivations, I'll review that and review a couple calculations, because the nature of the calculations that you are allowed to do in such a theory is relevant. And then I'll talk about gravitational corrections to gauge couplings, the gravity itself, and then there's a little bit at the end on this connection to asymptotic safety, where, of course, running coupling constants are heart of the program itself. So Mohammed Anbar here has done much of this work with me. So let me just start the motivations. So in one way, I got into this first thinking about it from refereeing a bunch of papers that are associated with this work by Robinson and Wilczek, where they proposed that there could be gravitational corrections to gauge running coupling constants. The basic idea is simple. You do a gravitational correction to a gauge vertex. Gravity carries a dimensionful coupling constant, so this would grow like the energy squared. So in addition to the usual beta function, I know, so better use the classical pointer or the quantum pointer. There's a energy-dependent running coupling that's then not logarithmic, and it catches the imagination in particular. This is the behavior of it with all the running coupling constants. You see it turns negative. Because it's proportional to the energy over the Planck mass, it doesn't turn on until high energies. But then whether or not you can read it, you can get some of Frank's Wilczek's, I'm sure he wrote this sentence. Although neglect of the additional corrections is not justified beyond the Planck mass, it's entertaining to consider the consequences of extrapolating. And if you're so entertained, you get asymptotic freedom, because all the coupling constants run to zero if you naively extrapolate them. So that catches people's attention. That's basically one loop gravity has a negative effect, and it dominates because it's quadratic. Okay. Then the history of this is that soon after Wilczek and Robinson did this, there's a bunch of papers that claim that the coupling constants don't run, gravity doesn't make a correction. And these were followed soon after by papers that claim that it does run. And if you notice, some of the same people are in the same both author lists. Okay. And the difference between these two is dimensional regularization and cutoff regularization and reached opposite conclusions. So part of the effort is to say which one's right, why the difference, to explore this general idea of running with the energy squared, to ask the question. I mean, we use effective field theories all over the place these days, and many of them have this feature, like gravity, that you have a dimensionful coupling constant. And despite 25 years of phenomenology and chiral perturbation theory, they don't use running F pi's. So why not? And we're going to address this by just doing some calculations and seeing if we find a running coupling constant in it. Does the idea work? But then there's also, in the literature, many, many attempts to make a running Newton's constant. Some of them are pretty unsophisticated and are clearly wrong. Others are much more sophisticated. And particularly the one that I want to take seriously is this idea of asymptotic safety, the idea of an ultraviolet fixed point. So basically you define these running, you imagine renormalizing using dimensionless variables at some high energy scale. And if you take that scale to infinity, if these all run to some ultraviolet fixed point, then the expectation is that the cross sections of the theory will all be well defined. This is, of course, now a big industry, which there are more experts here than most places. But the important point is that it should be able to be addressed in the same context as the effective field theory, because the running actually is important in the perturbative regime. In particular, here's the cosmological constant, and while that running doesn't look that big, it's really quartic in the scale factor. And while I haven't done the calculation, Martin Reuter tells me that if you take the scale factor to be atomic physics scales, so angstroms, the resulting cosmological constant is about the density of water, so about one proton per angstrom cubed. Or that, so, and it grows quadratically after that. And you will see in the literature many applications where they use these running coupling constants, and Reuter has done it himself, and Weinberg has done some, where you try to do real-world phenomenology using running coupling constants. Is that a good idea? Is it not? That's one of the questions I'd like to address. Can we see this type of behavior, even if it's small, in perturbation theory in the region where we can control both of them? So that's the motivations. The tool is going to be this effective field theory treatment. And so here I'm going to do a little review of this. The basic point of the review is that we do have a quantum theory of general relativity over ordinary scales that both theories should be expected to apply over. It is a form that we know in the literature is the effective field theory, which can generate well-defined calculations, has well-defined limits. There may be extra limits that one needs to impose for gravity, but there are definite limits to the theory. But over ordinary energies, there's a way to do calculations. I like this quote of Wilczek, another quote of Wilczek where you get to see his sense of humor. The first part's tough for people whose first language isn't English. His portentous drivel and obfuscate doesn't translate real well. But the main one is the bottom line. There's a perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity that agrees accurately with all experimental data. Now, of course, the predictions are tiny and the data error bounds are enormous, so the agreement is unremarkable. But the perfectly well-defined quantum theory of gravity is what he meant to say. So that's the sense that I'm going to try to present it. So effective field theory answers what you might think is a central problem of quantum mechanics. Physics is an experimental science. We've learned the interactions and degrees of freedom from some level of reality. We don't know them at all energies. How can we do any quantum calculation if we don't know what the particles are at higher energies? We don't know their interactions. We can't even calculate them. So you don't know what you're missing. How can you do a calculation? Effective field theory is an attempt to, is a procedure that answers that question, where you do use the field theory with only the light degrees of freedom, even if they're interactions are non-renormalizable otherwise. Okay, so for the purposes of this talk, I want you to watch a few things. This idea of new operators in the Lagrangian loops generating higher powers of the energy. These are things that are happening in gravity and many other effective field theories. And what gets renormalized, which is not the lowest order thing, operators. Okay, so the main points are the following. You've probably heard some of this before. Anyhow, high energy effects are local, so the nature, even if we don't know it, what the high energy degrees of freedom are or their effects, is that, but we do know that they're local. So they look like some terminal local Lagrangian, whether it's trees like the Fermi interaction or loops like a mass counter terms. And in contrast, low energy propagation is not local, goes over long distances, whether it's trees or loops. Again, the long distance pieces are separated by being non-local. So the high energy effects, unknown that may be, get absorbed into the coupling constants of local Lagrangians, and that's all you need to know. The other feature that needs to be built in is this idea of an energy expansion, the expansion in powers of a low scale over a high scale. But once you do that, proceeds more or less as before. You quantize using the most relevant Lagrangian for low energies. The divergences are local. They get absorbed in local counter terms. And then long distance stuff is predictions. So we'll see that separation. So basically, the procedure is the same. We're going to step through this for gravity.
So the divergence along origin media due to massless fields.
No, no, yeah, even if, yes, that's right. Even if they're massless fields, the UV divergences are local effects. And so you can separate out the UV from the IR. Yes. Okay, so you basically proceed as normal. You identify your Lagrangian order by the energy expansion, calculate, renormalize, and do phenomenology. You have to measure your parameters, et cetera. So it's interesting to think of general relativity in this way. Are the problems of quantum mechanics and general relativity happening over the same energy scales where they're both expected to be valid? You know, over these scales, you know? Or are they on scales that are beyond our experimental knowledge? And so that's what the effective field theory does. It shifts our attention from the highest energy down to low energy. So the easy stuff is to do the general Lagrangian. The curvature involves two derivatives of the metric, as you know, so that you would, if I'm doing an energy expansion, I'd include a constant, I'd include two derivatives, four derivatives, et cetera, and I'd order it in this energy expansion. The cosmological constant being the first term is tiny. It's on our scales, it's negligible, so I'm going to neglect it, aside from maybe a comment here or there. The next term is Newton's constant. And these curvature squared terms, you can do phenomenology with them. They're bounded, they're dimensionless. They're bounded to be less than 10 to the plus 74. Actually, the bounds are probably a little bit better by a few orders of magnitude. But the basic thing is that they're essentially unconstrained by experiment. In chiral perturbation theory, the equivalent of these are 10 to the minus 3 in size. So you can quantize the theory. The best way, of course, is using covariant quantization, path integrals, background field methods, put all these tools together. And the pathway always goes through Tufton-Veltman there. Basically, expand around some background field. You then maintain the symmetries of general relativity. You can fix your gauge. Now you use harmonic gauge in the calculations that I've done. And then your ghost fields, blah, blah, blah. Okay, so the quantization is straightforward. The renormalization is actually sort of the boring part of the calculation. In the sense that it comes from the part that we don't believe. It comes from the highest energies. But for our purposes, the thing that I do want you to follow is what's the power counting theorem of general relativity, at least with cosmological constant equal to zero, is that each graviton loop always adds two more powers of the energy in the energy expansion. This comes from the fact that it has a dimensionful coupling constant, 1 over m Planck squared, and so you end up with two more powers of energy in the numerator to account for that. So one loop involves four derivatives, two loops involve six. Okay? And if you just plug away, that's what you get. At one loop, you find the divergence. Well, they're local as advertised. They involve the curvature squared, so that's four derivatives. They look like terms that are sitting in that general Lagrangian. You can define renormalized coefficients for these terms. And two loops, the answer is also known in pure gravity for two loop calculation. It's a heroic calculation, but there it is. It involves six derivatives. So the power counting works as advertised. Pure gravity is one loop, said to be one loop finite, because at one loop you can use the equations of motion, which tell you so the counter terms vanish. So these counter terms won't appear in any calculation involving pure gravitons. They could, in principle, appear in calculations involving matter plus gravity. They could also then be modified by loops of other particles, but there they are. Okay. So that, as I said, that's the uninteresting part. The effective field theory is supposed to focus you on the low energy part. So these guys are are boring, that they've been taken care of. The parameters themselves are not predictions of the effect of the field theory. We'd have to go out and measure them. Presumably they are some consequence of whatever the underlying theory is. But the things that are predictions are things that differ from local terms in the Lagrangian. Most commonly, this happens with non-analytic dependences in momentum space or non-local in coordinate space. So non-analytic means, like log q squared, you can't expand that around q squared equals to zero. Also picks up imaginary parts for various signs of the momentum variables. Square root also appears in calculations. They can't be part of a local Lagrangian. If I go to position space, these are non-local in position. Okay? So here's my favorite calculation. I'll run through it quickly just to show you how these things end up working. It's the correction to the Newtonian potential. We define the scattering potential, so it's a scattering process. And we Fourier transform it mainly just to display the nice properties of it. What do you expect? Well, if you're just standing there ahead of time, you can expect the following. You expect the lowest order to recover Newton. At next order, you should get Einstein, which is corrections of GM over R is a dimensionless parameter that gives you the post-Newtonian expansion. If you want something that's dimensionless and linear in h bar and linear in g, there's a unique form. G h bar over r squared is the unique quantum expansion parameter. And you also get short range stuff. This falls out, then you'll see why. Okay? So that's what you sort of expect. You'd expect these features here. If you go to momentum space, which of course is where you do the calculation, The Newton looks like 1 over q squared. Einstein looks like 1 over q squared times the root q squared. I don't know if everyone knew that ahead of time. I didn't before I did the calculation. In momentum space, the quantum piece looks like q squared log q squared. So q squareds cancel. You get log q squared. Fourier transform of log gives you the right power dependence. If you have q squared without a log, q squared over q squared cancels, gives you a constant. Fourier transform of a constant is a delta function. So the short range piece is the analytic stuff that comes naturally in every calculation.
Well, what part of the correction gives you the quantum
root? The root one I'll show you. Okay, I can tell you a little bit more when I show you the pictures. First, at this stage, an effective field theorist knows that the answer is going to come out finite. And it basically comes from the short distance piece being analytic. It's going to look like terms that give you constants. Here's how it works. The curvature squared has four derivatives, so it goes like q to the fourth. If you insert that in a diagram, you get 1 over q squared, q to the fourth, 1 over q squared. Gives you a constant, Fourier transforms to the delta function. Then there's other pieces, also vertex corrections that are divergent also give you the same feature. The local Lagrangian stuff gives you short range pieces only. The logs always come out to be finite at one loop. Okay, so logs are finite, and the square roots also. Okay, then you just do the diagram, and then the answer to where these classical pieces come from are the classical pieces come from that diagram and the box and cross box and from this guy. Okay, it's always, I can tell you, the feature is it always has a heavy particle propagating. In this picture here, the dots are the heavy particles and the double lines are the gravitons. It has two gravitons and then a heavy particle. They always come out of those diagrams only. Okay. And so next I'll show you these two here. The one that I said has the square root has it there and has the log. The other one just has the log. It doesn't have any heavy particle propagator. Anyway, you add them all up. you get the classical correction that gives you the post-Newtonian expansion, and you get a quantum piece that, as advertised, is finite, 41 over 10 pi. Okay. Some comments. Many people are surprised to find the classical correction in a one-loop diagram. I mean, most of the time when we teach quantum field theory, we tell our students that the loop expansion is the h-bar expansion, so that it at one loop, you shouldn't get any terms that are of order h-bar to the zero. It turns out that that theorem's wrong. It's not a theorem. It's never proven as a theorem. If you've ever tried doing it, there's an h-bar in front of the Lagrangian that you keep track of, but there's also hidden factors of h-bar inside. For example, in the Dirac equation, it's m over h-bar in the mass term. And if you keep track of those, then you can get h-bar to the zero effects. And here's one, and I have other examples if you need to see them. Okay. In fact, the classical piece was done back in 1980 or so. And they could have done the quantum piece at that stage. They did all the right diagrams, or they did at least most of the right diagrams. But there was sort of an expectation that it wasn't, or maybe they didn't know it was there. I've never asked. The quantum correction is tiny. If you put a Fermi here, this is about 10 to the minus 40 or 10 to the minus 50, something in that order, compared to one. That's bad news if you're a phenomenologist. It's good news if you're a theorist, because when you do perturbation theory, the best perturbation theories are ones that have nice, well-behaved small corrections. This is the smallest perturbative correction. This is the best perturbation theory of our standard interactions, not the worst. But the basic feature is that there's no hint of any conflict, that the effective, the same way that we do calculations in other effective field theories has worked here just as well. Okay. You may not care about this at all, but I have to tell somebody. Last night I finished a calculation where you do the loop diagrams without doing loops. It's a step along the way to doing the modern helicity formulations where you just multiply amplitudes together and you get your answer. And that's basically what you do here. This is slightly different in dispersive technique, but basically take on-shell amplitudes, you multiply them together, you do a phase-space integral, and you get the non-analytic stuff at low energies. It shows you that this idea of the divergences are completely irrelevant for this calculation. You get the exact same answer. Anyway, so don't want to spend time on it, but I had to say it. Another nice one that you see the same sort of features of the energy expansion at work is graviton-graviton scattering. The lowest order, so ST and U are the Mandelstam variables, so this S cubed over TU is first order in the energy, so this is a dimensionless amplitude, kappa squared, energy squared. And at next order, you get terms like kappa to the fourth, energy to the fourth. You get these logs like predicted, you get double logs from box diagrams. It again shows you the energy expansion. This is one where the coefficients in the higher order Lagrangian disappear for another reason. Remember, it's one loop finite, so the gravitons satisfy the equations of motion. So there are no counter terms here either. This is a finite answer. There is, if your eyesight's good, you can find a 1 over epsilon sits right there, but it's an infrared effect. It's cured by Bremsstrahlung radiation in the usual way. It's basically a scattering amplitude can radiate soft gravitons. Once you do that, you get a nice finite answer. Now, they say it's like a low energy theorem of quantum gravity. No matter how you complete quantum gravity, whether it's string theory, loop quantum gravity, anything, you do graviton-graviton scattering or the Newtonian potential, you have to get those numbers out independent of your ultraviolet completion. Okay. Anyway, so this changes the way we think about.
So is there an easy way to see this? So you're saying that any one loop any one loop graviton process is going to be finite.
Yeah, any one loop that just involves pure gravity is finite. Okay. Yes, exactly.
But at higher loops, I guess it's going to be finite.
At higher loops, there'll be a divergence proportion of that Lagrangian that I showed you there. The two-loop one is the two-loop, the unique two-loop divergence.
And is it that you just absorb the divergence of the one-loop divergence into G Newton or something? Or
no, it just disappears. It disappears because the counter terms are ones that vanish for pure gravitons.
They vanish on shell.
Yeah, they vanish on shell. Okay. That's right. So that's the source of it in the gravity case. Okay. Anyway, this I think it has changes the way we think about the problems. It's not that general relativity and quantum mechanics are incompatible. They work like other effective field theories, but that there's something flawed about the effective field theory at the highest possible energies. But that's the normal state. We don't know Planck scale physics yet. So while we'd love to do that, and this doesn't answer all the questions that we need to know, it's at least some progress. Okay. So here's things I want. I probably beat this to death already, but let's just say them quickly. The loops. Well, yes. Yeah, so it tells you. The corrections are going to be small. Yeah. So I sometimes go off on a little tangent at this stage and say that the only way you're going to see it is not as a correction to one, like the calculation that I was showing you, but as a correction to zero. There might be some time when you get zero plus something, and that something is potentially measurable for good luck. But I haven't found it yet. But I'd love to see that. But as a correction to something that's classically allowed, it's not going to happen. Okay, so the features, it doesn't modify the original coupling, so it's not a renormalization of G Newton, the higher order ones, and that you expand matrix elements and powers of momentum. Okay. That's going to be the feature of the rest of the talk too. So, but you already see now the conflict between running couplings and the gravity contributions. Gravity is not going to modify the original coupling. It's going to modify a different coupling, a different Lagrangian. It's a higher order. And so it's not the original coupling. That's an obstacle. It's not, however, completely inconceivable that you could do it. What we've essentially been doing is we've been renormalizing at zero energy. And so we normalize at zero energy, and then each derivative counts as higher powers of the energy. If instead we decided to renormalize at a higher energy scale, E, we take some thing that looks like constant plus G Newton times Q squared, and maybe absorb some of that G Newton Q squared into the original coupling. So you take some of it away, and then you've got a smaller correction out there. Okay? So if this is going to work at all, you've got to find some way to absorb some effect from renormalizing at higher energies into your lowest order coupling. Then that's some running coupling constant, and you've done something useful. You've reduced the size of the one loop corrections. Okay. That's what Robertson and Wilczek were doing. Here is exactly that. They have the coupling constant, they've got the one loop correction, E minus E zero. And so then the beta function was the effects of the higher order. So that's exactly what they're doing. What makes it successful if you do that? Well, one is that it better be useful, that this coupling constant, you can always define a running coupling constant, but it should be useful in some way. It should capture some quantum effects. Even if it's not every single piece of the quantum effects, it should be at least some of it. So sum up some set, And the alpha s of q squared does that, or alpha of q squared, if you do radiative of z decays or z production through photons, the alpha at the z mass is what enters, sums up a set of radiative corrections. It should also be, at least in some sense, universal. In renormalized coupling constants, this in renormalizable gauge theories, this always happens because the logs get tied to the divergences. So if you do dimensional regularization, it's 1 over epsilon plus log q squared. So the logs and the renormalizations are tied up together. So renormalization is universal, so the logs are universal. And so here's where we're going to find the obstructions that we can't get around. One is that the quantum corrections here are going to not be universal or maybe not even useful. So they won't satisfy these conditions. One of them is just tied to crossing. These expansions are in Lorentzian space in terms of momentum. The momentum doesn't carry a definite sign. You can take a single reaction and cross it over, and so q squared changes from plus to minus. And so if you have some quantum corrections, in one case it's going to increase the effect, in the other case it's going to decrease the effect, and it's the same reaction. So you'll find out that we'll see that making a running coupling constant that absorbs things like q squared is plus e squared does damage to the other reaction. It's not a useful thing to do. Then the other is the... Yeah, but they don't. Yeah. Okay. Then the other is the universality problem, where if I have different processes, these coefficients are different. And so if I observed an effect here in one process, B over I, even if I took the same sign, it's not going to be the same in a different process. And one of the things that you'll see, I'm just going to step through a bunch of processes, and you'll see how far out of whack these are. They look nothing like each other. Each process is way different. So the claim will be there's nothing useful or universal that you can do. Okay? I'm probably going to skip this for time reasons. The renormalization group in effective field theories is a well-known topic, but it has nothing to do with the running like we're talking about here. It basically predicts higher powers of log q squared, so the two loops that can predict q log squared of q squared by doing a one loop calculation. I don't know. There's a lot of work done on it, but it's well understood. I'm just going to skip it. It's nothing what we're talking about. So let's do gauge interactions first. Here, our lowest order operators are the current operator with a coupling charge, or mu nu squared. Higher order operators would have extra derivatives. It could be derivatives on the A field, or in a minute I'll show you derivatives on the psi field. There's actually different operators. There's enough of them. There's different operators with derivatives on the gauge field. Some of these are related by the equations of motion. They collapse down, particularly these two collapse down to current-current interactions, J times J, constants, by using the equations of motion either here or there. But others don't. And I'm just going to sketch the calculation. The type of calculation is just like we would expect. Now, you get the lowest order vertex unchanged. You get some higher order one, kappa q squared. Kappa is some constant, which has 1 over epsilons and log q squareds in them. If you take some matrix elements, I'm doing some process, I want to do some scattering diagram, I do the vertex corrections like that. I have this new operator here. The divergences that appear there, q squareds cancel q squareds, it looks like a constant. So you define a renormalized coupling constant. I get the lowest order Lagrangian and higher order stuff, higher order with a log q squared, but not 1 over q squared. That's the main thing. And this accurately describes the corrections to the next order operator. Okay? It works for both the regular reaction and a cross reaction. And the main thing is that this piece changes sign under that and that one doesn't. So now, there's also photon vacuum polarization corrections, which also have exactly the same feature. They cancel, the diversion pieces cancel. So you take those and put them together. Can we define a running coupling constant that depends on the scale in some way? Well, you can do it in, so here's the amplitudes, here's the answer. Can you make this running coupling constant divided by Q squared plus maybe some shifted value of this new parameter? Okay, the answer is no. You can do it for either positive Q squared or negative Q squared by choosing the sign right. So that if Q squared always stayed positive, you could get, this could absorb some of the effect of this, you know, at least near Q squared equals to M squared. It could be a reasonable calculation. But it would then be totally wrong in the cross channel where that changed sign, and now it doesn't give me the right answer at all. You can't make the work for both. So this is the crossing problem. It's also a universality problem, because if I take a different reaction, I get different operators, I get different coefficients, I get, again, the same renormalization procedure happens, but the coefficients are different. And so for this process, I would define a running coupling constant that had, even if it tried to work for one value of the crossing parameter, it would have a different number. Okay, we'll have enough examples of that later.
So can I ask?
Yeah.
So is the summary of what you're saying is that if you don't have a renormalizable theory, then you cannot define a renormalization group?
Well, the renormalization group is actually defined. It's that work that I showed you there. But it doesn't have anything to do with the running of the bare coupling constant, the leading coupling constant.
Well, okay. Running of the coupling constant doesn't make sense if it's not renormalizable.
Right. That's right.
Okay. So is it because you were in the beginning in the context of pure gravity?
Yeah.
So does that survive when you
have matter? Yeah, I'm going to do pure gravity in a minute.
What?
I'll do pure gravity next.
No, but does it survive when you have matter fields? Are you saying that matter what you do, G Newton never gets renormalized?
Yeah, that's well, yes, you'll
that's
see
the
that.
Punchline.
That's the punchline. That's where I'm headed.
Okay, good.
Okay. Now, what about the
cells? Some people are unhappy.
Yeah, I know. but you'll see the evidence coming up.
So I don't understand that. So then what do you mean by the fact when you say the renormalization group is well-defined?
Yeah, so the renormalization group is the following. You have to excuse me a bit if I run over time. But basically what they do here is when you do one-loop corrections, you renormalize higher-order operators. And so there's some logs associated with this. Log mu is associated with that. If you then put this into another loop, so it's a one loop diagram of this, you're going to get log squared mu's. And log squared mu's are going to be correlated to log q squareds. So you're going to be able to do a one loop calculation and get the equivalent of a two loop log q squared, which only happens at two loops, out of a one loop calculation. Okay? So that's the context of the renormalization group is basically following that the physics doesn't depend on log mu. Log mu has to be canceled by log q squared, okay? But it doesn't have to do with running f pi in this case, or running g in the gravity case. Where was I? All right, so this actually agrees with the calculations that people did in dimensional regularization. That's what I was using, of course. What about people who did the cutoffs? Here's the mistake of what happened in the cutoffs, is people calculated, put a cutoff in, found that the lowest order operator gets renormalized because kappa lambda squared, and they interpret that as a running coupling constant. So you've got a cutoff, you take the derivative with respect to the cutoff, and it obviously runs. The problem is that if you actually look at the effect of that cutoff, it changes the interaction at q squared equals to zero, at the place where you measure the electric charge. And if you go and you complete the renormalization process, you take that should be bare charge squared, obviously. The bare charge, and with this cutoff dependence, it totally disappears into the renormalized value of the finite structure constant, 1 over 137. Once you do the renormalization program all throughout, you get exactly the same thing as dimensional regularization. you get, instead of log mu, you get log lambda, but everything else is the same. This guy disappears into the bear charge. It's not a running charge, it's just renormalization of the charge. So in the end, if you just carry the thing out to a physical process, there's an agreement between the two schemes. And this has now been agreed on by at least one of the people that's in those two columns. So he's now got a third paper where he agrees.
Who is that?
You also have
David Thoms. David Thoms. David Thoms was actually a reasonable person to correspond with in this process. I'd say there were others that were not. Okay. Now, so the gauge coupling, I think maybe I beat it to death and I want to move on to gravity anyhow. Moving on to gravity. I'm going to do some of the same things. I'm going to take a bunch of test cases. I'm going to look at different effects that you can calculate and say, is this a good running coupling constant? Is this one a good one? Is that one a good one? Do they appear in other processes? And this gets boring, but let's try to do it quickly. Here's the first one I'll look at. Is look at the vacuum polarization. If anything could be universal, it's the vacuum polarization. But even that's not universal. So here's the renormalization of the vacuum polarization diagram plus the lowest order one. Here there's, again, at least two ambiguities. So it has this Q squared log Q squareds, and then there's divided by mu 2 squared and mu 1 squared, in case you can't see that. Those are related to the renormalized coefficients of the quadratic pieces there. Okay, if you take non-relativistic calculations, you get one number. If you take the original propagator and look at the correction of that one, you get a different number. They're not that far off, but they at least have the same sign. But they're at least a different number, so they're not universal. They also have the crossing problem. If I take Q squared positive or Q squared negative, they go different directions. The other feature that's bad about it is we know in pure gravity that these coefficients from higher order operators drop out because it's one loop finite. So the log mu squareds that sit here can't even occur in pure gravity. Those are going to disappear from all pure gravity calculations. And finally, just in case you want to do this and you want to make it a Euclidean theory, these have the effect of increasing the strength of the interaction, not decreasing it. Okay, so this will follow signs of it too. Okay, graviton-graviton scattering. We saw that. And you'll notice that there's nothing in this that looks like these definitions. You know, there's things, ST and U carry different signs, so they go different directions. And it's a complicated feature. I said this part already, but if I just take some kinematic value, some central piece of graviton-graviton scattering, right down the middle. And try to renormalize all the variables being large energy, I get something. It's a positive correction, but it has nothing to looks nothing like the number that we had before. Okay? How about do graviton scattering from a massless scalar? So here's the massless scalar tree level, here's the higher order operator. You do all these diagrams, Dunbar and Norridge again, know how to do these calculations. You're supposed to look through that. Here's the renormalized operator. But you're supposed to look through this and find a renormalized G Newton. If you do it at that central point again, it goes negative. Okay, so but then the numbers have nothing to do with anything else. How about if there are two different types of particles? I should have put Muhammad's name up there. Muhammad did this. This has the crossing problem because I can do A plus B goes to A plus B, or A plus A bar goes to A plus, or B plus B bar. Again, so the different diagrams, again, you're supposed to identify a running coupling constant in there. You can't. If I do one reaction, I get a negative effect. If I do the other reaction, I get a positive effect. The numbers are all different from everything else that we've seen. What about using the non-relativistic potential to define it? Well, I can do that, and it's a definition. I could just include all the diagrams and say, here's a running G. Well, you say, well, I shouldn't include the box diagram. Here's the box diagram. We never include that in running coupling constants. So you take the box away and you change the sign. And maybe I shouldn't do some of these diagrams here.
So why do you take diagrams out?
Well, I mean, in usual running coupling constants in QED, QCD, you never include the box diagrams in the definition of running coupling constants.
Why?
Well, you know, the real reason is that these are finite diagrams. They don't renormalize the charge. Okay?
Okay.
Okay, so these diagrams here renormalize the charge, so that's what you do, because you want it to be universal. Here we don't have that condition anymore, so I'm willing to take them away. Okay, but I'm just looking around to see what makes sense, and clearly I'm trying to have as many things that don't make sense. Okay, but if I just do the things that you do in QCD. I get one sign. If I do the things I do in QED, I get the other sign. So again, numbers and signs don't make any sense here. They jump around all over the place. It's not a good way to categorize the quantum effects here. So by running through all those, I hope that I've convinced you there's no good definition of a running coupling constant seen in these calculations. There's various ambiguities, universality, and kinematic. And so this then poses challenges for people that want to do running coupling constants seriously. So let me try to spend a moment trying to make connections to asymptotic safety.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So I imply, if I could rephrase the discussion in terms of observable quantities,
right,
which I defined in some operational way,
right,
would the ambiguities go away?
Well, no, that's what I've been doing. Is these ambiguities are there for observational things. You can always make a definition that works if you're not willing to, if you don't tie it to an observation.
No, but if you write something like V of R, that's
right,
not what I call an operational definition.
Okay, so yeah, so I can define any one of these makes a definition that operationally can make sense. So I can take any one of those processes and make an operational definition by, because I've calculated scattering amplitudes or of various forms.
And that's covariance.
Yeah. And the question then is, that definition, does it translate to any other process? And the answer seems to be no. So if I do it for this, a nice observational definition, it doesn't have anything to do with graviton scattering, which is another observation. Okay. So the point has been to do this, is to see if the observation that there's something that jumps out at us. Okay. So I'm trying to make some connections between asymptotic safety and this effective field theory. And in fact, I think we're at a stage here, it's not really my credit, where we can do this. And answer some of these questions. So let me try to explain asymptotic safety. I'm a little embarrassed to do that in front of real practitioners, but let's do it. I imagine that I'm going to be in Euclidean space for the moment. I'll get out of it eventually. I'll define the theory at some scale. So let's imagine I have the space of all the parameters here, the coupling, the dimensionless G Newton, cosmological constant, these other parameters. That fills up with infinite dimensional space. And I start at some place where I, at some scale mu, where I assume that I've defined these coupling constants. If I started, let's say, right there, I'm given a set of coupling constants. And then I can imagine a procedure where I extrapolate those up to, so I've integrated all the modes beyond some scale mu. And then I can gradually add those back in. I can go up and up and up. And much of the time you do that, you'd run away to infinity on all your couplings. And so this is the usual paradigm of effective field theory. You'd say at some stage I've got to truncate this, and there are new degrees of freedom. that come beyond some scale, and so the running of this would stop at some scale. New things would come in. Asymptotic safety, then, in this picture, would be that you run to a fixed point where the theory continues to make sense as you take mu goes to infinity. If you're on one of those trajectories, you could also then imagine extrapolating back down to mu equals to zero. So mu is equal to zero is the real world. It's the theory with all the quantum modes from zero to infinity included. So this point there or that point there, there's presumably some surface of points, is the real world, and that should match up at mu is equal to zero to our effective field theory. Okay? So in practice, there's the one they cut off the modes by adding a piece quadratically in the effective action that is big at small scales and is vanishes above some scale, so that only the quantum effects above the scale count. They get cut off below that scale. And then you can look at how the effective action varies with respect to that scale by taking derivatives with respect to the scale, sensitive to the physics near the scale. You truncate. Various truncations are possible. They give you running coupling constants then that depend on the scale, the dimensionless one. And in some particular scheme, it looks like this. This is some particular cutoff. You get a fixed point in the ultraviolet. And if you solve that as a renormalization group equation, you get a running G function. Okay, so that's in some sense, I don't know if it's a too trivialization, but that's what seems to be done. So, and this has many challenges, and I'm not going to be interested in so much in the challenges, though everybody else is. Of course, there's infinite numbers of couplings, so you have to truncate, but that's understood. The people doing this are smart people. They know that these are issues, and they're working to address them. I'm more interested in the issue of how one matches this to the effective field theory treatment, which says that things don't run, but this is clearly, just by hand, if you just do these things, it's easy to see that those are definitions of running parameters. You can just do it by hand, and they run in that calculation. So what I'd like to do then is just to see, imagine doing one loop calculation, extrapolating down to mu is equal to zero. So let's imagine I'm starting somewhere where the effective field theory is valid. And this effective action is really, and it can be expanded as individual matrix elements. I mean, it's most efficient to do it in a background field method and then only at the end use the expansion. But I think it shows you how the theory is constructed. To do it, the expansion of this in Feynman diagrams and then run. So if I were to do that, so I expand that and I'll get individual matrix elements that look like something. Here's a pretty, you know, hypothetical one. Graviton exchange with some stuff on the outside, some vertices and two propagators. And then this matrix element would run, and present practice has only the running of this cutoff factor is the relevant piece. So you take the derivative, you run, and present to you the running coupling constant is packed on externally. But then you can run each individual diagram down to mu is equal to zero. And the net result then is running from infinity to zero, you have the running piece. This is how it runs. That's like the beta function to one loop. You've got the running coupling constant, and then you have to integrate from infinity down to zero. Actually, I got the sign wrong. Anyway, sorry. So each individual diagram would look like this, and so you could imagine doing calculations with those diagrams. At that stage, the advantage now is that you can, here's an expression that's the real world, so it's mu is equal to zero. It can be continued now to Lorentzian space, so I can take the external momentum to Lorentzian. And you see that you get the long distance pieces of effective field theory, basically from the bottom end of this integral. this cutoff vanishes at mu is equal to zero. The G Newton is constant down at the lower end. So basically, you just have d mu over mu times mu d by d mu. You, that trivially integrates to give you just your usual field theory diagram at the bottom end. Okay, so all the long distance pieces are there, and this is now being seen in the effective and the asymptotic safety world by matching to some of the vacuum polarization diagram that goes into the Newtonian potential calculation has been seen, and so things like this can be found in. So this, but this formula looks like a regularized version of effective field theory in the sense you get those same long distance pieces, but the UV stuff is made finite by the running coupling constant. So in a sense, this is the good news. This matches to effective field theory. It seems to match with all the long distance pieces being there and all the short distance pieces being regularized by the running coupling constant, so you get finite effects. But the question is, so that's there. But this then also has the feature that since it matches exactly, it doesn't reproduce running coupling constants in Lorentzian space. The Lorentzian expansion of all these would be just the same things that I got before, but with coupling constants that are predicted by asymptotic safety. And so it's not clear that given this, that Weinberg's original goal is satisfied by present practice. This idea of defining Lorentzian or Minkowski space cross sections in terms of these parameters, we saw this is not how the effective field theory works, yet this gave you the same sort of corrections as the effective field theory. So you end up with an effective field theory with an infinite number of terms in a Lagrangian. You get coefficients that are not unknown anymore, they're related. Your loops are regularized, they're not infinite. But it's not clear that that's a better behave theory than just the effective field theory. You have an infinite number of reactions to make finite, you have a continuous value of the kinematic variables. Can you make all of those finite at all points? And I think that's a challenge now for the asymptotic safety. So now my conclusion there is that it seems capable of reproducing this effective field theory, but then therefore doesn't, says that the running in Euclidean space does not translate into running in energy. So it's not appropriate, for example, to do cosmology with running cosmological constants. They don't run in the region where the applications are being met. Okay. So overall, here's my overall summary. I've tried to argue that in the region where we can do perturbation theory, that the running coupling constants are not useful because they don't absorb a defined set of quantum corrections. They're not universal because they don't renormalize the original coupling. They're very different in different reactions. I'd argue that most cutoff calculations probably are misapplied, and that there's still some progress to be made in understanding the application of asymptotic safety in the Lorentzian region. Okay.
Other questions?
Just for me to understand, would magnetic moment run if I take a charged particle with a graviton loop and external photon?
It wouldn't be well described by running. I mean, it will give you a Q-squared dependence, an extra Q-squared dependence.
It will have a log Q-squared, though, right? Because it will be G Newton times the mass of the particle times the log, right? So could I...
So if... You know, it's probably not G Newton times the mass of the particle.
Why not?
Because I've never seen that happen in a loop correction. It's G Newton Q squared by kinematic variables.
Okay. No, I, by dimensionality, it has to be mass of the particle.
Yeah,
no,
it's already
dimensional.
Yeah, I know, but if you actually, if you put H bars in that, it goes, that goes like 1 over H bar. And I did the work by Goldberger and Rothstein on making a classical effective field theory solves the problem that bugged me for a long time. Is GM squared over H bar is a dimension, it sounds like it's dimensionally correct, but it does not have the classical limit right. Okay. They by reformulating the theory by basically like a heavy quark expansion where you remove the mass from the theory before you do loops, showed that the classical limit exists and the term that you have doesn't appear.
No, I'm talking about the virtualities and the loop much larger than the mass of the particle, so it's not a heavy quark.
It's not what?
It's not a heavy quark limit, right? So the,
yeah, no, but okay, but if the virtualities are much heavier, then it goes over to GQ squared anyhow. Because the virtualities are then governed by the overall momentum in that case, not the mass.
I don't.
If that did occur, then we're having trouble with the classical limit. Because it's the H bar goes downstairs in that case.
No, it will run between the high scale and the mass of the particle, and then it will freeze.
I don't think you'll get GM squared effects. And I think that the way to do that, I mean, at the mass of the particle, the Goldberger-Rothstein treatment is appropriate when your momentums are much smaller than the mass of the particle. And then I think they've solved it.
Well, I can have all external momenta small, but the momentum inside the loop is higher.
Yeah, and that will be GQ squared, or else be divergent.
I can be log divergent, right? I'm forming an operator that is dimension, whatever, 6, right? Mass of the particle times psi bar sigma mu in your psi. It cannot be quadratically divergent, for sure. It can be only log divergent. So this one will run, I say.
We can talk about it, but I don't think so. I don't think it occurs.